Good evening. You're listening to a Life Worth Living podcast with Dr. Foye. This is sponsored by Lifesavers Emergency Room. Today we have my good friend, Dr. Vasilakis, is on today. He is a renowned plastic surgeon here in Houston, Texas, and he's going to be telling us all things plastic surgery today and cosmetic surgery. So we're really grateful that he's here. I know he's a very busy guy. And so welcome, Dr. Vasilakis. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. And pleasure is all mine. I'm very happy to be here and talk about plastic surgery today.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the field of plastic surgery. Is this something you grew up wanting to do, or you kind of stumbled into it?
Not at all. It all came very gradually. So I grew up, first of all, I grew up in Athens, and I wanted to be a doctor from a very young age, but it never occurred to me whether I want to be a surgeon or not. So I wanted to be a doctor because I wanted to help. It was something that I thought was very honorable to be able to dedicate myself to medicine and helping others. And that led me to going to medical school, and I went to medical school in London, actually, in England.
Okay.
And that's when I realized that surgery was my vocation, and I wanted to receive the best possible training. So after I graduated from the University of London, I decided to come to the United States because I really wanted the intense training and the approach that the U.S. Medical system, or training system, I should say, offers. And that led me to New York, where I did my plastic surgery training. And eventually I came to Houston, and I chose the field of aesthetic plastic surgery for many reasons, and I have not regretted it. I have not regretted it since.
That's amazing. Is there any particular experience that you had that led you to want to go into plastics or surgery in general, or did you have epiphany?
Yeah, so during our third and fourth year of medical school in England, we were exposed to all different surgical specialties, and from general surgery to neurosurgery, orthopedic surgery, and plastic surgery. And as in a teaching hospital where I was a medical student, there was a lot of reconstructive surgery, and there was a lot of microsurgery, which involves a very, very fine work of tissue rearrangement and reconstructing and transferring tissues and working with very small vessels under the microscope. And that I found very, very interesting. And so that took me actually, while I was a medical student, to Taiwan, where I was some very, very world-renowned places, very renowned institutions for microsurgery. And I spent 2 months doing microsurgery, literally day and night. And that led me to wanting to be a plastic surgeon. That introduced me to plastic surgery. And actually, that introduced me to the American or the U.S. training system. And that led to me deciding to come over here and train. So it was more of a gradual thing. And I just, fell in love with plastic surgery pretty much every, more and more every step of the way.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. And is there any specific area of plastic surgery that you specialize in?
Right now, yeah. So initially during our training, we get exposure to all aspects of plastic surgery. Plastic surgery is a very, very wide specialty, and encompasses a lot of different surgical subspecialties, including hand surgery or wound care, burn reconstruction after burns, and burn care. Breast surgery, cosmetic surgery, craniofacial surgery, pediatric surgery. It's a very wide field, and that's one of the reasons a lot of us, including me, want to get into that field, because we get a very wide exposure, and we're able to help patients of different kinds, or different kind of patients from pretty much all ages with all sorts of issues and injuries and all that. So it's a very wide. So after being exposed to that, I eventually chose aesthetic surgery because I wanted, I felt the challenge of taking healthy patients and carrying them through their journey to eventually get them where they want to be. And also, it suits my personality. It also suits my skills. And we have to be realistic. In today's world, you cannot do everything. You cannot have a practice where you practice everything. You can't have to subspecialize. So of all the fields, I chose cosmetic surgery because it suits me. And also I see a patient who's a healthy patient go through the journey, essentially getting them where they want to be. And it really, really suits my goals and suits my personality.
So you've said healthy a few times. So should that tell, you know, the most people that in general, aesthetic surgery is something that would be ideal for healthy patients? Or how do you deal with patients who are not entirely healthy? Maybe they have blood pressure out of control or diabetes that is not well controlled, but they do want that tummy tuck or they do want the breast lift, things like that.
Oh, they have to get it under control for sure. For sure. So, In most fields in medicine, especially surgery, a patient comes to us vulnerable. So somebody may have cancer and need reconstruction after cancer, or somebody comes in because they have a wound or because they have sustained some sort of trauma. So these are vulnerable patients. In our field, in cosmetic cosmetic surgery, that's not the case. Most patients are not vulnerable. They want they see an issue that they want to treat or a goal they want to achieve or multiple goals that they want to achieve, but they're not vulnerable. Now, if they do have an issue such as high blood pressure that's not well controlled, diabetes that's not well controlled, anything that really can cause complications or can increase the chance of a complication, then certainly we do not proceed with cosmetic, which is elective surgery, but we tell them to get these conditions under control and then reevaluate. Because we do, it's very important we get somebody, we need to, because this elective surgery is surgery by choice, so we need to be as safe as possible and decrease or minimize the chance of a complication to our best of our ability.
So how do you help people have realistic expectations? I mean, for example, a 50-year-old patient, 50-year-old breasts are not the same as 30-year-old breasts, I'm sure. So how do you help people manage expectations of what they should, what you're able to deliver for them? How do you kind of have that conversation with patients so 100%. They'll be satisfied at the end of their treatment?
Yeah, that's an excellent question because this can be very challenging. Actually, nowadays, I feel that it's easier for patients to have realistic expectations or actually to get them to adjust or readjust their expectations because social media and it's a visual field. So you can show photographs. You can say, hey, this is a typical similar patient of you. And this is what we can achieve versus in the older days when the pictures were not as available, videos were not as available. Social media did not exist. So the most important thing is to sit down and spend time with them and then talk to them and show them pictures or refer them to your website, refer them to your social media pages and look at this with them or just talking to them and say, hey, this is what we can do. And also talk to them about the process of aging, the process of childbirth, how the body changes and what are the goals of each surgery. And hopefully you will come to an understanding and the patient works with you and you work with the patient as a physician, and then you proceed. But it can be a challenge, but communication is very important. Being able to be patient and understand that most of the patients are not from the medical field. For them, it's very, very, it's something very new. They just got introduced to the process. And also they feel vulnerable as well. They might not be able to express themselves in a consultation room. They can be very uncomfortable. So it's a matter of making them comfortable and have a conversation sometimes as their friend, as somebody who advocates for their best outcome. And I think there's just a matter of just listening to them.
So what do you do when it's the other way around, where what they want is not necessarily safe or even in your opinion is not necessarily aesthetically pleasing, but they want that, you know, we see the BBLs, we see the ginormous boobs out there where sometimes I see people and I'm like, which doctor did this for you? Like who, you know, how do you have those conversations where you try to bring things down to what normal proportions or not, you know, what usual proportions should be?
And it's a very common trap for the plastic surgeon to understand that it's not realistic, but it could, if everything went well, we could get close to that result and see it as a challenge and actually do the surgery. And most of the times it doesn't work. Like the patient will not come close to their desired outcome. And we have to resist the temptation of proceeding with that surgery and actually saying no. We have to learn to say no and say, initially when I started, I used to be a little more flexible in terms of, hey, you know what? We cannot get 100%, but we can get there about 60, 70%. Right now, I just say no. I just say, I have the experience. I've done this thousands of times, and I have the experience. I know how you're not going to look good. I want happy patients. This is not something you should do. I advise you against it. You can seek a second opinion, but I'm not going to be your surgeon if that's what you want. And I'm just being 100%. Yeah. It actually just happened today. I had a patient who I've actually scheduled for surgery who wanted to upsize her implants by 300 cc. I just said, no, we're not doing this if that's what you want. And I was frank with them, with her. And patients will trust you. Patients will trust you if you're honest with them and say, you're just not going to look, it's not good for you. It's not good for your tissue. You're not going to look good. And you explain to them in lay terms why they're not going to be happy if they go for that. Then I think they, most of the times, they understand.
Right. And I mean, I know that what you're doing is very important for individual patients and just the people, you know, the community at large, because people really have this desire to be attractive and look attractive, and it affects your self-confidence. Would you say that you've had experiences where you walked away feeling just as happy as the patient? Do you have those sort of happy, warm and fuzzy moments in your field?
You mean being as happy as the patient, or?
Just, you know, those success stories where you leave feeling, well, this is why I do this. This is why I got into this field for that field.
Hopefully happens it's not what I think or what the surgeon thinks, it's what the patient thinks. Sometimes you get a perfect result, somebody looks really great, but if the patient's not happy, it leaves a bitter taste. He says, you know what, I wish she was happier because she looks great objectively, because that's a great result. Sometimes a result is not suboptimal, but it's not as great as you'd want it to be for whatever reason. And the patient is ecstatic. And you feel so, as all plastic surgeons, I believe, feed off their patients, because ultimately our goal is to make somebody happy, change their lives for the better. So if we achieve that, the patient comes in and says, I feel like a new woman. I wear better clothes. I feel better when I go out at night. I have enjoyed this experience. Everything was smooth. I'm very happy. I'm really happy I went with that, and I did not regret this decision. That's all actually you're asking for at the end of the day. That's really all you're asking for, because that's how we measure our result. We don't have a number. We're not treating. When you treat hypertension, you have the numbers you go by, right? When you glycemic control, you have a hemoglobin A1C or whatnot. But in our field, we don't have something objective. It's how the patient, it's the feedback we get from the patient. That's really all that matters. And that's what we're doing that for, ultimately.
Okay. What would you say are innovations that you are seeing in your area that are helping your work to be easier, or your work to have better outcomes in the practice?
So, contrary to what many many people believe, it's not the technology. The technology, I feel, is some we have more tools. That's true. We have more tools in our disposal, some skin tightening device or some non-invasive lasers and radio frequency technology type of modalities and treatment modalities, but this hasn't really made a difference in our practice. At least I don't believe so. What's really made a difference, two things have made a difference. One is safety. Right now, we have a lot of studies that have come out in the past 10 years or 5 years that have really, really, really equipped us with knowledge in terms of doing these procedures, especially long procedures, in a very safely manner. Okay. That is so, so, so important. We can do a lot now very safely and not having to not putting our patients in danger, from BBLs, knowing where to inject, how much to inject, the safe planes, to DVT prophylaxis, to fluid management. All that stuff have really, really made us just better in what we do. So I would say this is the number one innovation. This is the number one, I should say, advancement Yeah, that's the number one advancement. And the other one is just techniques. There's been a lot, significant effort to really, for, you know, a lot of surgeons have really, really taken leadership in publishing their results and their techniques. And that has really just enhanced our results and what we can achieve surgically. And you're really showing the quality of the work. For us plastic surgeons, we just do better work now than we did 5 or 10 years ago. And this is a collaborative effort on behalf of all plastic surgeons to just enhance and move the specialty forward.
Tell us a little bit about your educational activity. You're involved in a lot of research. I saw that even on your website for your practice.
So
you're still doing?
Not so much nowadays. I did a lot in residency and even more as a fellow. So I wanted to invest a year just studying aesthetic surgery. So after I finished my training, my plastic surgery residency, I went in an extra year in a very very prestigious institution for aesthetic surgery in Charlotte. And I published a lot there because I was inspired in terms of just learning more about what we're doing, the aesthetic techniques, about safety as well. And doing research really helps because you really immerse yourself into these procedures and into whatever you're studying. You just become better just by studying day, pretty much every night, more and more and more, just to carry out all this research work. I did a lot in body and breast surgery, a little bit of face as well, and facelifts, but mostly I studied safety in these procedures as well as advanced techniques. And that really helped me. But I did most of that as a fellow and as a resident. Nowadays, I just have my practice just doesn't allow me to emphasize and dedicate that much time. But hopefully, in the future, when we get fellows, if we get residents in here to help us do that, then I'll go back to it.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely needed, and all your contribution that you've done so far, I'm sure, has made a lot of impact in the field. So thank you for that. Tell us all about trends and shifts that you're seeing in patient preferences. I don't think BBLs were as popular as they are now 10 years ago, right? And I'm sure breasts have always been a desired thing. That's just a natural part of the body that tends to go down. And so I can see that may not have changed much. But do you see different trends every couple of decades? What has been your experience with this?
What we see now is we see significantly less desire for the exaggerated look. At least in our practice, we see less and less patients, less and less women wanting big BBLs. They still want a BBL, but they want it elegant. They want it relatively small, athletic, not overdone. The same with the breast. They do not want overdone breasts. So if we are to place an implant, it's going to be more on the smaller side. If we are to remove an implant, it's most of the time is to place a smaller implant in or remove them completely, actually. We'd see a lot of lifts. Basically, we see patients want to look, they do want to look different, but they also want to look natural. So we see a lot of, hey, I want to look natural. I don't want to look overdone. I don't want to look fake or plastic. And this is something that's really changed in the past, I would say, about 3 to 5 years. We see a lot of that. We see a lot of patients after weight loss. So the number, when I was a fellow, only about 10% of women who have so-called massive weight loss after bariatric surgery or weight loss surgery, only about 10% actually seeked body contouring surgery and breast contouring surgery to remove the excess skin and then feel better about themselves, exercise more, wear clothes better, etc. Now that percentage has increased significantly through social media, through education, through awareness. And that's actually something that I think is very, very beneficial because these are some of the patients with the highest satisfaction because truly it's aesthetic surgery, but it's also reconstructive surgery because it changed somebody's life. And I think that this is important. The other thing that's important, I would go less patients, at least in our practice, less patients seek hyaluronic acid fillers. They go for more natural approaches with fat grafting.
So you're, well, what we were saying is that basically a lot of patients are looking for more of the natural. They want to look good, but they don't want to look overdone. Yeah. And they're just more natural bodies. How do you help advise patients who want a breast lift, but maybe they don't have enough tissue and they don't want implants? Are there options for patients who don't necessarily want anything inserted or anything like that?
Certainly, more and more women do not want an implant. They don't want it because there's so much in the news and the media about breast implant illness, the capsular contracture issue, the fact that most of the time implants have to be exchanged, et cetera, or removed after a certain amount of time. So a lot of women don't want implants. What we do is we're just being honest. The other option is fat, just taking fat from through liposuction, taking fat from another area of the body and transferring it to the breast. That's a great alternative. It's not as powerful as an implant. It will not increase the cup size significantly. Half a size to one, maybe one and a half is all somebody can expect. But it's something and it's natural. Okay. Mm-hmm. So a lot of women opt for that option, and it can actually happen second and third round to increase the amount of fat. But if somebody doesn't have fat, then there's nothing to do. Tell them and you're honest.
How are they able to have BBLs with these butts and not be? And why is what's different about the tissue in that area in the breast? Why is the breast not able to take that expansion?
Because it's a gland, and where it's not. Where when you inject fat into the butt, you have the skin and you have a space in between, and then you have the muscle, you inject above the muscle, and that takes it better. But when you have a breast, you have a gland. So there's different organs. It's an organ versus a structure, and fat behaves differently. So we know that a higher percentage of fat is resorbed and not permanent when injecting the breast and the butt. And we tell this to our patients, and they understand that. They understand that. But yeah, if somebody's very thin, that they don't have fat, implant is the only option. And sometimes patients just opt not to do anything, just do a lift and just leave it at that. Most of the times there is some fat. There is some fat most of the times.
Okay. How do you stay updated on the newest trends, developments, research in plastic surgery? Do you do CMEs? Do you travel? Do you go to other plastic surgeons and see what their technique is to see if, as new techniques develop?
Yeah. So the most important thing is having great colleagues. So here in my practice, I work with two other great plastic surgeons who've been in practice longer than I have, and I always learn from them. So they teach me. So we all talk to each other and we collaborate. So we always share our knowledge to make sure we are better, we're up to date. So if one reads an article that's beneficial to our practice, we share it, we discuss it. If somebody has a friend or a colleague that talks about something that's interesting and beneficial to us, we share it with each other. We share our experiences in the OR. We share our techniques. If we try something that works, a patient experience. So we talk to each other. That's the greatest source of knowledge and greatest source of staying updated. The other thing, obviously, is conferences. Again, because the three of us, we go to different conferences and then we come back and say, hey, I learned this today, or this so-and-so is doing that. And just by having your ears open, who tell me what comes out in the literature, what's in the news, etc. So CME as well, of course. The plastic surgery literature is very, 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 very strong. There's always innovations happening and things to learn. Just having a passion for getting better results and getting better overall as a surgeon and a physician, I think that's enough to eventually continue to improve and improve.
So without speaking badly of any, colleagues or other plastic surgeons, what is going on in Miami? Why, why is that the haven of plastic surgery, and why is it so cheap there, and is it safe? Well, what would be your advice to sister who maybe your younger sister or cousin who's like, I'm going to Miami? What would you say to someone that you
care about? I would say, first of all, there are amazing plastic surgeons in Miami. For sure. Like in every other city, a board certified plastic surgeon does have the standard to operate at an extremely high level, has the ability, the standards, the ethics. Is your surgeon a board certified plastic surgeon? And are they going somewhere for the surgeon or the quality of the practice? Or are you going just because it's fashionable to go there. So Miami has some amazing plastic surgeons, but at the same time, there are providers who are not doing procedures within their expertise. And that's why you see, or there are technicians that work in those facilities that should not be carrying out these procedures like BBLs. So I think it's a matter of, In terms of the cost, yes, in Miami, because there are so many doing it and they rely on volume sometimes more than quality. I don't have first-hand experience. I've never worked or trained there. I can't really talk about it, but yeah, there have been some, for example, there have been deaths, you know, from following BBLs, but I don't know what happened and why not. But not every plastic surgeon in Miami is dangerous. There are some amazing plastic surgeons in Miami, but what I would advise our listeners or anybody who's looking to get plastic surgery, research their surgeon and make sure the surgeon is board certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery. And that's an excellent start.
When you say research, we're talking about, should you be going to the medical board website to see if there is any cases? What kind of are you looking at Google reviews? What
everything, everything. It's not one place. A plastic surgeon who's board certified, that will be on their website. That's a good start. So you know, look at their training. Were they trained in plastic surgery? Are they board certified? And then you look at their facility. Where do they operate? Do they have their own standardized facility? Do they work at the hospital? Do they work at some sort of surgery center? That's not. The other thing is to.
Is it better if they're standalone or if they're at a hospital? What does that tell you?
Sometimes, yeah. If somebody's not certified, if it's not a board certified plastic surgeon, they cannot operate at hospitals. They don't have hospital privileges. So if you find out, if you ask the surgeon, hey, do you have hospital? They say no, I don't have hospital. Then it could be that's because the person is not certified. It's not actually, it does not belong to the specialty they claim to belong. And that's actually a problem in Miami a lot, because if there's a complication or any issues, then that surgeon that provider cannot treat you. So that's very, very important. And the other thing, of course, is to look at the results on the website, as well as the results online in their social media, and see whether they actually proficient and, you know, they can do what they say they can do, instead of just taking their word for it. But the number one thing is make sure they belong to the specialty they claim to belong.
Does it matter how many surgeries they're doing a day? I've heard of some surgery facilities where they're doing like 6 or 7 operations a day. What is a safe number for a surgeon?
You cannot do 6. There's no human being that can do 6 mommy makeovers in a day. That is impossible. So if you hear a surgeon doing 6 mommy makeovers, 6 BBLs a day, it's clear that he or she is performing part of the surgery. Then there are some assistants. Nobody knows. These are typically not surgeons. There are providers or assistants or technicians or PAs that are doing the surgery while that surgeon just moves on to a room. So essentially, this is definitely a substandard way to practice. It's substandard practice. That this is not something that anybody should consider. So make sure that the surgeon does everything from beginning to end. There needs to be a reasonable amount of cases per day for that surgeon. For example, you know, if it's mommy makeover, should be one mommy makeover per day. Can be a few small. Somebody can do 2 tummy tucks per day, for example, or 3-4 breast augmentations per day, but nobody can do 6 BBLs in a day. All right, that's not possible. That makes no sense.
Yeah. Well, this is good because, you know, I think most people, we're a little intimidated when you go see a surgeon for whatever, you know, this is who's going to do the sleeve. You're putting your life in their hands. And sometimes you don't know what questions to ask. You don't want to offend. You don't want to look like you're grilling them. Where'd you go to school?
You can always ask the surgeon's patient coordinator. That's another trick. Collect all the questions and send the list of questions to the patient coordinator. Then will answer for you, or the surgeon will answer for that for the patient. But that's an excellent person. Coordinator is an excellent source of information about the surgeon. And also another thing is the reviews as well. The reviews is also very, very, very important, because a lot of negative reviews typically imply that there's something wrong there. You, maybe not in terms of this, maybe in terms of the practice or the process, or but there's some, if there's a lot of negative reviews, there's something there typically.
So tell us a little bit, for a woman who is interested, would you advise that women finish having their children, finish childbearing ages before they get into any sort of reconstruction?
Yeah. 100%, unless there's massive weight loss. A lot of the times a woman is in her mid-20s or late 20s and they've lost 100, 150 pounds and they want to have children in the future. That patient will go ahead and have body contouring and breast contouring surgery despite the fact that they will have children in the future, because there is a significant impact of that excess skin into their lives. But for everybody else, finish having children, finish breastfeeding, and then consider plastic surgery, because after, with childbirth and pregnancy, the body changes. So having plastic surgery before will be negatively affected by having children afterwards. So if a woman knows that she's going to have children in the future, then they should wait having like major plastic surgery. I'm talking about minor things. I'm talking about major plastic surgery.
Okay. And what's your definition of major?
Tummy tuck? Like a mommy makeover, a tummy tuck, breast lift or breast reduction. And that would be like a major.
I feel like I've seen a lot of younger women with breast augmentation, though.
That's okay. Because, that is very common. And pregnancy will change the breast around the implant. And then you can go ahead and do more surgery in terms of getting the shape right around the implant, or even exchange the implant or remove the implant. But that's acceptable. Breast augmentation is acceptable.
Okay. How much do you see, and I don't want to take up too much time, we have about 10 more minutes, but how much do you see mental health playing into your field or the patients that you take care of? Do you end up sort of becoming a counselor to some extent?
Yeah, commonly. But the most important thing is to screen the patient by talking to them, by having long conversations during the consultation process, and talk to them and realize whether their desires are essentially manifesting, but there's something behind it. Because if you figure out that there is something behind it, just manifesting as the desire to do plastic surgery, then you have to stop. Then you have to say, you know what? Plastic surgery is not for you. And that's actually common. So you don't have the time to be a counselor and just stay there and talk to them, but you try to figure out whether there's something else behind the desire to do plastic surgery, because that is usually a red flag. And that does play a role. Something else, it's also important to liaise with the patient's doctor, the general practitioner, or the primary care physician, because very often they will tell us that, hey, this person has been treated for psychiatric problems, or this patient has been, let's say, depressed or upset, or had obsessive compulsive tendencies, and plastic surgery is not really for them, because they might not reveal it to us, the patient might not reveal it to us. But that's why we get a primary care doctor to actually talk to us about the patient, because they know them much, much better. Mm-hmm. So that's when we rely on our colleagues to help us to not hurt that patient by doing plastic surgery if they do have a mental issue.
What kind of medical clearance process do you have for patients? They have to have a physical before, come with labs and things like that before they can get a scheduled date?
Yeah, for most patients, an assessment by the primary care doctor as well as the labs is enough. There are some patients who are more complex in terms of their medical history, and then that's when we send them. We require an EKG or a chest X-ray. If they had, for example, cardiac problems, then we ask for the cardiologist to weigh in and do a risk stratification. If they have complex rheumatologic problems, for example, which is common, that we ask, we talk to the rheumatologist. But most of the time, primary care physicians know their patients very well. They can manage most of their issues, such as, high blood pressure, diabetes, all these conditions that we need to have them under control. And that's usually enough.
I think what I did learn from some cases that I've heard about is that if one surgeon has told you that they don't feel like you're a good candidate, but you go shop and find the surgeon that will do it for you, there is a higher likelihood that a patient would have a bad outcome because what the first surgeon said was correct. You were not a good candidate for it. And we see cases where I've heard of cases where patients will travel, you know, leave the country and things like that to go have that surgery that someone here has recommended, has, you know, told them they don't think they would be a good candidate for, or their blood pressure or, you know, whatever other medical conditions may have made them not a best candidate for.
100%.
For those who are hearing, if you're a surgeon, you get a consultation, they're telling you what they think is in your best interest, whether you want to hear it or not. So definitely we don't want people going doctor shopping to find who will do that.
100%. Surgeons like to operate. We want to operate. So if we tell you that we don't want to operate on you, there is a very, very highly, most likely we know what we're talking about.
Right.
Should listen to us. Surgeons want to operate. Like a race car driver, right? You want to drive a pilot. You want to fly the plane. You know, if they tell you that I'm not going to fly that plane, it's not safe to fly the plane, you should not get on that. You should not find another pilot. You should kind of like stick to the first pilot who told you that that plane is not safe to fly. Right. That's the analogy.
Yeah. Well, Doc, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure.
This has been incredibly informative. I did have one more question. So do you have an age range for patients? Like, what's the oldest patient that you've operated on, and what's been the youngest patient that you've operated on?
Well, you can operate on patients pretty much, especially as plastic surgeons. We can operate from, you know, newborns to, you know, the older people. But in terms of aesthetic surgery, You can do breast reductions in teenagers because you're greatly affected by really, really enlarged breasts. And you can do, I removed implants, really, really bad implants on somebody who was 73 years old a few weeks ago because she really needed to. It really helped her life. Now, you got to do it safe. You got to do it, you know, you got to make sure that all the comorbidities are very well controlled. You got to make sure you don't do too much. If a patient, for example, that patient actually wanted new implants in, I said, no. You're not getting your implants. If you want me to be your surgeon, we're removing the implants, we're removing the capsules, and that's it, right? So if you start to try to do too much, that's when you get into trouble. You just make sure you, as a plastic surgeon, as a board certified plastic surgeon, it's my duty to help the patient. And if I feel I help the patient and everything else is controlled, then we're doing the right things. We're doing the right thing. And that's the rule for every age range.
What about the opposite side of the spectrum? Have you had any cases where they're, not adults, maybe 17, 16, and they do want the augmentation?
I wouldn't do it. I would tell them that they're still growing, that the body's still maturing. And I would not do it. I have not had, but if I did, I would tell them no. We usually screen those patients because they might submit, they might want to see us, but we just said tell them no. We can just read. I wouldn't see a patient who's 17 years old and wanted breast augmentation for cosmetic purposes only. Sometimes some patients have deformities, like congenital breast deformities, or that's a different story. But if somebody just wants, 17 years old and wants a BBL, for example, I would not even see that patient. I would tell them to wait a few years for the body to mature, think about the decision, and then come to see me.
Great. Yeah. Awesome. These have just all been very great.
I hope so.
Thank you so much. I'm sure everyone who's listening is going to be more informed and better informed and more at ease with being able to approach and go see a plastic surgeon. But we want them to come and see you specifically. So tell us a little bit about your practice, the name of it, where it's located. And if you know your IG handle, that'd be great as well.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, we are a practice with 4 plastic surgeons now. We are called Memorial Plastic Surgery. We are in Houston. We are well known for our body contouring and breast contouring work. I do a lot of patients. I operated on a lot of patients following weight loss, mommy makeovers, abdominoplasties or tummy tuck, cosmetic breast work. And we're located in Houston. We are called Memorial Plastic Surgery. And the handle is Dr. Vasilakis.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Vasilakis.
My pleasure. It was really great.
Bye-bye.
Tired of waiting at the ER? Lifesavers 24-hour emergency room is your number one ER for pediatric and adult medical care. Staffed by board-certified physicians with absolutely no wait time. Lifesavers 24-hour emergency room is equipped to handle life-threatening conditions quickly. Your emergency or concern is our priority, and we are here when you need us. From allergic reactions to concussions, migraines, slips and falls, car accidents, heat stroke, broken bones and sprains, sinus and ear pain, asthma attacks, and more. We have state-of-the-art equipment and technology with an on-site CT scanner and X-ray machines, as well as a full-service lab for immediate results in 24-hour pharmacy services. Our dedicated Kids Corner keeps your little ones occupied while you are attended to. The pediatric room is specifically tailored to soothe your child and ease the stress of their medical condition. Worried about COVID-19? Lifesavers ER is Houston's go-to destination for rapid COVID-19 testing, treatment, and care. Our board-certified ER physicians and ER nurses will quickly get you the urgent care you need. Lifesavers 24-hour emergency room is your ER for immediate care. Now with three convenient Houston locations, open 24/7 to get you feeling better fast. Our Willowbrook area location is located at the intersection of Highway 249 and 1960. Our Heights area location is in the Garden Oaks Shopping Center at 3820 North Shepherd Drive. Our Summerwood area location is located off the Sam Houston Tollway at Westlake Houston Parkway.